Okay, we will convene the meeting at 1:05 today, February 2nd, a Friday, 2018, meeting of the House Resources Committee. I'd like to call the meeting to order. Members present are Representative Birch, Representative Parrish, Co-Chair Tarr, Representative Rauscher, Representative Drummond, Representative Johnson, myself, Representative Josephson, and the co-chairs have asked newly appointed Representative Lincoln to serve as our vice chair, and he's accepted that. So I welcome Representative Lincoln. Please let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Deborah Tillinghast, and our LIO moderator, Eileen Keim or Kim? Keim. I remind members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. This afternoon, we have two presentations regarding House Bill 322 on our agenda. First, the Director of the Department of Environmental Conservation's Division of Spill Prevention and Response, Ms. Kristen Ryan, will explain why HB 322 is needed. Then my staff, Tom Atkinson, will walk us through the bill explaining what it does. And you might find that in some ways the presentations will be a little bit redundant, but I don't think that's a problem. I think it's actually useful. After Director Ryan presents each slide, you may pose questions regarding that slide or a previous slide. Do members have any questions before we start this afternoon? I don't see any. So, Director Ryan, please put yourself on the record and you can begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. My name is Kristen Ryan, and I'm the Director for the Division of Spill Prevention and Response for the State of Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. And today I'm going to give you just a brief overview. I probably won't dwell on my slides and give you time to ask me questions a lot, because I assume there'll be a lot. But I'll give you a brief overview of what the division does and why we think our penalties could use some improvements in general. So briefly, what we do, the Division of Spill Prevention and Response responds to spills of oil in particular, but also other hazardous substances. And we define any spill, essentially a release of something that's damaging to the environment is considered a hazardous substance. It's a pretty broad, general explanation of what's hazardous. And obviously our intent is to protect the environment and public health, as is the mission for the department. We publish a report biannually at the request of the legislature. You probably received an email. We used to give you hard copies. We stopped doing that about a year ago or 2 years ago because it's big. And we now provide this electronically. It's on our website, but it's a compilation of all our data, of all the spills we've responded to, where they were, how much we spent, just all that kind of general information you may be interested in the world of Alaska and spills and contaminated sites. I grabbed a few slides from that report this year to give you some statistics. As you can see, we break the state out in various regions. You can see we respond usually to about 2,000 spills a year. That's pretty standard. There are a lot of spills we don't go out to visit. That 2,000 doesn't mean we're out in the field at 2,000 times. It means many of those are just phone calls for technical assistance. The largest was related to boat sinking out in the Aleutians. That's the largest volume for last year anyway, but you can just get a sense of all the other spills we have there. Processed water is considered a hazardous substance, as is, if you think about it, produced water. So just the difference there, processed water is something that's used in like a mining operation that they're using when they're processing the ore. And so a spill of that slurry, we call that processed water, but it's considered hazardous by the definition in our statute. And I'll just keep going. Feel free to ask me questions as I go along if you have any.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, of the 125,000 gallons spilled in the Aleutian, how much were attributable to that individual boat sinking, approximately?
87,000 gallons. It's in the sub-note text of the slide. It's kind of hard to see, though.
Oh, yeah, there it is. Thank you.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have probably pulled that out of my hat. Anyway, so boat sinking are very common releases at mines where there's oil exploration and production, you know, your standard stuff.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. is the when you talk about a penalty, is that for
punishment, or is that to recover? Is that intended to recover the cost of the spill? And if that's the case, in how many instances do we have the, you know, I mean, if you've got a trucking outfit that spills some oil, I'm assuming that they, at some point in time, they accept responsibility to come in and pick that up. And I'm trying to understand the difference between penalty and trying to, you know, kind of solve a problem, if you will, through the chair.
Yes, Representative Birch, through the chair. Our statutes require us to regulate certain companies to prevent spills and respond to them when they occur. That doesn't include the whole universe, right? Usually it's where exploration or production is occurring. Those are the people we're regulating. And they are required to have the financial responsibility to clean up a spill if it occurs. So penalties only come into play if the state deems the company should be penalized for causing damage or harm to the environment. Cleaning up a spill isn't always perfect. As you know, there's often residual contamination that's we're unable to clean up, or a company's unable to clean up. And penalties are often, in our case, used for deterrence and encouraging companies, perhaps if they are continuing to have releases, to remind them that they should fix that problem in the future and stop having those releases rather than spilling it and cleaning it up.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
It is not a revenue generator.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, on this slide, thinking back to some of the conversations we had last year about, I guess there was Hillcorp Cook Inlet, Hillcorp North Slope, and then one other, and forgetting which one. But the Hillcorp Cook Inlet, because it was gas, there was that conversation about AOGCC versus you. That's not reflected on this, but the North Slope Hillcorp would, because that was an oil leak. Is that right?
Representative Tarr. I would say the conversation we had in this committee last year is kind of the impetus for where we are today. There was a lot of questions from the committee about our penalties and what we would be penalizing various companies for, related to some releases that had occurred during that time frame. And this legislation, as drafted, would give it just increases existing penalty authority, that the amounts that can be considered pretty much. It doesn't really change what we would penalize for, if that makes sense. I mean, the same companies. So the natural gas release, we deem that as a hazardous substance.
Okay.
So technically, these authorities would impact it, I guess, is the most direct answer to your question. I'm not sure. That was never challenged, our interpretation of that release as a hazardous release in the environment, and there was some disagreements on that. But
And just a quick follow-up.
So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. So then that would be reflected in the 62,527 gallon hazardous substances.
Yeah, correct. I'm not sure we could capture natural gas in a gallon, so
okay,
I don't
yeah.
think that is reflected in that number, but that's where you would expect it to be, yes.
Okay.
I'll ask a couple questions here, Andy Josephson, for the record, and I see that, for example, in Section 8 of the bill, there's reference to 46.14, and that's an air quality section. And I came across that in reviewing the committee bill. So the increase in fines might affect air quality in some way. Is there? Can you
tell me which section you're looking at again?
Section 8, line 3.
Representative Josephson, yes, this section E of 4603760, for the rest of the committee, this is the department's penalty authority. The 760 covers a lot of penalties for a lot of the department's programs. The changes proposed in this legislation primarily impact spills and penalties associated with spills, but some other releases to the environment that would be violations are also impacted. And here, I believe that section refers to cruise ship vessel, passenger vessels discharges, but I'd have to go back and look at the reference. There are a few areas impacted that aren't related to spills of oil or petroleum, but not very many.
Okay. And a follow-up, on slide 3, where you talk about 2,046 substances released and not traveling to the site of each one, I'm thinking, for example, in Bethel, there was a release of several thousand gallons, I think, of some sort of fuel.
Yes.
And how would you send out someone for something of that size to inspect the site or during and after the cleanup, or how would that work?
Representative Josephson, it depends. Every situation is a little bit different. It depends on what contractors have been hired to go to the site and if we have a relationship with them and can be assured that they're going to comply with our laws in the cleanup. And that situation, that's what occurred. We were monitoring it and would have gone out, but the contractor hired, we have a good relationship with them, knew they understood our rules and what needed to be done, so we just had a lot of communication via phone. If we can avoid going out and saving money, obviously that's, we think that things are going to be done okay without us present, then that's, you know, that's fine.
Okay. Did you have a follow-up?
I don't want to hammer this home too much, but this, I'm just wanting to understand how, you know, if this is the information that's reported and you're saying, you know, because I was just figuring you had some formula for conversion calculation or something like this. I mean, that was such a concern for folks last year because of, you know, the length that spill was, you know, for the length of time that spill was occurring and because of the ice conditions and all of that. So how are you reporting that if you're otherwise not doing some kind of calculation like one cubic foot of natural gas is 0.012 gallons natural gas? I mean, if you're not doing some other kind of calculation to account for that, I mean, could we add in another metric then that would just represent that? Because I think that was part of the conversation was just sort of, you know, if we should have any additional events like that, you know, how are we going to address that and how will we evaluate sort of, you know, how significant the ongoing problem is perhaps with the infrastructure?
Representative Tart, yes. That was the first time we've had a natural gas release into a water body, essentially, right? It was an underwater pipeline, which is why we decided it was hazardous to the environment. You're introducing natural gas into this aquifer that it doesn't normally exist there. I need to go back and check. I don't believe it's included in these calculations. I'm almost positive it's not. Otherwise, that would be a much bigger number because it was an ongoing release for a long time. In the future, we will probably, if that continues to be an issue, I'm sure we can find a way to report that in our annual report. And it may be in another page that I didn't pull up. I'm not exactly positive. And like I mentioned before, our decision to decide that was a hazardous substance was controversial.
Okay.
And we believe our statutory authority would consider that to be a true statement.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Proceed, please.
Okay. Again, the next slide gives just some general statistics just to give you a sense of the decline that we've seen in the released volumes of this is oil, I believe, not just petroleum, but crude oil. And this actually is petroleum products in general, because the big bump was a ship, so I know that was that was petroleum, not crude. But the point of the slide is we've seen a decrease, and we attribute that a lot to industry being very responsive. We have a lot of really good players in Alaska that care about our environment and want to do the right thing and do the right thing without our involvement. And we like to think our regulations have something to do with the decrease as well. We've seen a direct correlation between companies we regulate and compliance. And the reason I say that is there's a lot of people we don't regulate and we just don't have as good a compliance there. Just an anecdote, probably. So in general, we have great operators. Number of spills, again, you see a decline, same reasons that we believe is occurring. There's always a blip now and then that's substantial from a big event. But
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the decline in the number of spills and a decline in the volume of spills, what's the genesis? I mean, why are you being spurred on to initiate an increase in fines if whatever's going on now seems to be driving down the number of spills and driving down the volume of spills? I'm looking through a sponsor statement that indicates that the House Resources Committee welcomes support for this legislation, and I'm not sure I'm one of those, but I'm just trying to understand why now?
Representative Birch, through the chair, the governor's office has not weighed in yet what their position is on the legislation. I want to be clear about that. The bill has just been introduced. But I think, I can't speak for Representative Josephson, my understanding is, and my belief is, that our penalty amounts are pretty antiquated. They were originally written in the 70s and the 80s. They haven't been updated. They're really not worthwhile at this point. I mean, they're really minimal amounts. They're not commensurate with the potential harm caused by a release to the environment.
Follow up. Do you have a commensurate graph that shows the amount of penalties leveled on, recovered, if you will, that kind of tracks along with the number of spills and over time? I haven't seen that, but I mean, I don't know. And where does that go? Does that go into the state treasury? Does it go into a special account, or how is that money recovered?
Representative Birch, through the chair, so the penalties we collect at right now go into the oil spill response hazard fund, which is the sort of the bank account that pays for our services down the road. The legislature takes allocations from that fund to give us our operating budget on an annual basis. So it does continue the life, I guess, of the overall fund that pays for oil spill prevention and response services for the state. I don't believe I have a slide that shows you a correlation between penalties, and we can give you some information on different penalty amounts that we've collected over the years, but it's just the way the statutes are written right now that it's not the easiest path for us to go down to issue penalties and fines, and the amounts are pretty small.
Yes. Do you have a rough order of magnitude estimate at how much was recovered over the last year, or the last 5 years, or some period of time? Is it in the hundreds of thousands, or millions, or tens?
No, it's under 100,000 a year, I would say. But let me get back to you to be
okay.
Accurate.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so just kind of to follow on, even though the number of spills may be going down, I guess what I want to make sure I understand is that, even in with the fewer spills, because the amounts haven't been adjusted in so long, it's fewer spills, but it's still not enough to actually cover the cost of the cleanup associated with the fewer spills. That's where we're at today.
Representative Tarr, through the chair, yes, the amount that we're restricted to charge for a penalty in statute are very low. For those few incidences where we have a substantial release, we really would be limited in recovering and penalizing, frankly, the company for the release that harmed the environment.
And Mr. Chairman, just
follow up.
And so under those circumstances, you still have the responsibility of completing the cleanup, and it just means that it's, basically a cash negative operation at that point, where the state then is paying the rest of the cost.
Representative Tarr, through the chair, yes, if the responsible party did not step up to the plate and pay the cost to clean up the spill and the state stepped in, yes, our penalty authorities are would probably be inadequate to help us recoup our costs.
Thank you.
Representative Rauscher.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Through the chair, let's see, what constitutes a spill? In other words, you see the word spill and you think of barrels of oil floating down whatever body of water. And we have a record. We have counted the number of spills. So I guess what I'm wondering is, what is a spill? Is it a teaspoon? Is it a quart? Is it a gallon? Is it a barrel? Is it lots of barrels? What do you have to do to qualify to get on this list, I guess?
A Representative Rusher, through the chair. There are varying levels of reporting depending on who you are. Mm-hmm. And companies that we regulate are required to let us know everything. Now, we don't expect it immediately, depending on the volume. They send us a list once a month for very small volumes, say, hey, we spilled this, and this. If it's a larger spill, I don't know the threshold right off the top of my head, depending on what kind of product it is and what receiving environment it's in, they have a different timeline with when they have to report it. But our generic authority says a spill of a hazardous substance to the environment is just that, a spill. That's the pretty broad authority that the department has access to.
So could a dot on this? Oh, follow-up. So I'm sorry. Thank you very much. So could a dot on this be a court or less?
Representative Rusher, through the chair, no, I do not believe these dots represent a court or less. I have to go back. I'll give you more specifics.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, Representative Birch.
I just wanted to help out. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I worked at Alyeska Pipeline, the daily reports that if there's a tanker in the berth, a teaspoon or more would be reported. You know, so it's very, very small quantities, and at least in some cases. And as a follow-up to my earlier question, Mr. Chairman, do we have an estimate as to what the volume? I know you're going to do some research on the amount collected over time, but do we have an estimate as to what the valuation of that fund is, the kind of the cleanup fund that where these penalties are accumulated? Is there
yes. Got a
I'd be interested in knowing what that dollar amount is or what's in that fund.
Okay. Representative Birch, to the chair. And yeah, and like I mentioned, yes, companies we regulate do report. They're required to report everything. And when they report it, though, it varies by amount and receiving environment. And, yes, we publish. The Department of Revenue manages the revenue streams going into the fund. There are several ways that fund is replenished, and there are two accounts within the fund. There is the response account, which is capped by statute at $50 million. That is for emergency responses. That's the state's, we need to get on this right away fund. And then there's our prevention account, which pays for our daily operating costs. So there are two uses of the fund based on those accounts. But the overall amount of the what's available in those accounts, I don't want to give it to you off the top of my head. I know the response account is hovering around $44 million, I believe, right now. And then the prevention account, I don't exactly know how much is in there based on the revenue streams. They give us quarterly updates. But I will provide that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Okay. So we are on page 5, and I think we're through that.
Okay.
Unless you're not.
Page six. Nothing really exciting there. Just gives you a sense of spills occur where people are primarily, because that's where fuel is, and that's what gets spilled the most. There are three main situations where spills occur. For our world, is based on where spills occur, because that impacts dramatically how you clean it up. If it's to water, it's a very different scenario than to land. And obviously, underground oil leaks from tanks also have a different pathway to the groundwater systems that we're trying to protect. So I won't go into all those details, but just let you know that's how we look at the world. An example of one of our employees doing some work to try to find a leak. Why do we do this? Obviously, oil and petroleum products and hazardous substances are considered harmful to human health and the environment. That's why we do this. We're trying to avoid human contact through skin, inhalation, ingestion. We're trying to ensure our environment stays the way that we love it, since we're all Alaskans and are here for that purpose. This is home heating oil release, which is not uncommon to see something like that when you have a release. Impacts, you know, this is pretty basic stuff. You guys know all this. There's the reason we do it. It's harmful to human health and the environment, and that's why we're avoiding it, and that's why companies want to avoid it. It's not good for anybody. Truck rollovers have been pretty common lately. I know that's a point of conversation. I know there's a lot of confusion in the legislation about which trucks would be required to get a contingency plan. As the bill is written right now, the state interprets it to mean only trucks, commercial trucks hauling crude oil would be required, if this bill became law, to get contingency plans. And a contingency plan essentially is our way to know you're preventing spills and what you're going to do if you have one. What's your contingencies? Where do you have equipment deployed? Who's trained to do it? How are you going to get there? It's just the who, what, how information that I'm sure companies hauling crude are already doing. It just isn't coming to us.
And if I might, Chair Josephson, for the record, just to follow up on that point, currently, if a person is carrying a refined product and they have a rollover like this.
Yes.
And I've talked to you about my concerns with some of that. There's no requirement for a contingency plan. Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. We do not regulate trucks hauling refined fuel products. We, as in the Division of Spill Prevention and Response, they are required to have insurance requirements and meet certain safety standards by the Department of Transportation. But we don't have any contingency plans in place for refined fuel or crude oil. This bill would put us in the business of regulating crude oil transportation as written.
All right. And we've been asked why crude oil should be treated differently and whether that's fair sort of in the overall economic scheme of things. So if you could take that up, that would
be
helpful.
Mr. Chairman, crude oil, obviously, there's differences, like I've said, by the receiving environment and the thing and what is spilled, how we're going to respond to it. There are some things that are easier to do with crude oil. It's thicker, so sometimes it's easier to pick up. But it's also more persistent and more toxic in the environment. So from our perspective, crude oil is a more dangerous thing to have in the environment than refined fuels. It's not saying refined fuels isn't bad either. We just feel that it presents more risk to the environment and human health than gasoline. That is one reason why the department has concerns about the hauling of crude oil by tanker. That's occurring in a couple areas in the state. It's not a real common occurrence, but it happens. It's starting to happen in ways we hadn't anticipated.
Okay. I think Representative Drummond, did you have a question?
I actually had pretty much the same question, okay. But you said it better than I did. I'm frankly shocked that we don't govern spills of refined products, jet fuel, aviation, gas, gasoline.
And let me follow up on that. You said that that your division doesn't have require contingency plans. There's no statute requiring that.
Correct.
For refined products. Does DOT, either state or federal, require a contingency plan for refined products?
Mr. Chairman, no. DOT does not require contingency plans for spills. What DOT requires is insurance requirements. To the credit of the Trucking Association, because we've seen an uptick in spills from refined fuel trucks going up to the North Slope to haul refined fuel up for usage up there, we have been working with them to try to minimize or reduce those accidents from occurring, and it's paid off. I think spending more time with, and when you look at the reasons, the causes of those accidents, it's usually operator error. So a little bit more upfront training of drivers to remind them not to do certain things while they're driving and to take certain precautions has, I think, paid off dividends. I think it's a reason we're seeing a reduction in those accidents. But just the pure volume of traffic is driving those numbers up. There's a lot of trucks hauling refined fuel right now around the state. Since they closed the refinery down on the North Slope, that is how they are getting their refined fuel up north. And they have their insurance requirements. We do not have any contingency plan requirements for those vessels, those transportations.
Thank you. Co-Chair Tardy, did you have a question?
Mm-hmm. two quick things. So one is, and maybe this is a good time, it seems, to kind of do this interface, is that, you know, some of this is, though, regulated through, like, say, Clean Water Act, if it has the potential for a discharge through the non-point discharge elimination system.
Mm-hmm.
And so those folks are federally required, and this is just boring technical work I used to do, but to have their stormwater pollution prevention plans. And so some of that will be captured, so it's not entirely regulated. And so maybe you want to talk about just sort of the interface of those two. But it piqued my curiosity when you said the tankers happening in a couple places in the state. So this is something other than double haul tankers coming out of Valdez, I guess. Is that what you mean?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, that's the predominant pathway where we're seeing the large transportation of refined fuel occurring. But, yeah, I mean, it occurs all over the state. I mean, fuel's moved around by truck. That's common.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to emphasize there's a lot of requirements that they're complying with that just aren't contingency plans. And if they do have a spill, they are required by us to clean it up. It's not that they don't have to respond adequately. If their insurance their insurance values are adequate. It depends on where the spill occurs, frankly. Some environments may be extremely expensive to remove any spilled fuel. But we work with them when they do have a spill to try to ensure that they can clean it up and to meet our standards. So there is the response standard is still there. It's just the prevention aspect of the contingency plans is not there.
Okay.
And follow-up.
And so if we're talking about the tankers coming out of Valdez, I mean, post-Exxon Valdez oil spill, the requirement that they all become double-haul tankers was implemented. And I guess is there a – so I'm not following entirely if there's, like, a different technology. I guess at the time that was kind of, like, the safest option, but I don't know if there's something that I'm missing out of your comments.
Okay. I misunderstood you, Ms. Chairman. I thought you were talking about – I'm talking trucks because I'm seeing a truck in front of me. You're talking about boats.
Yes,
tankers.
<sorry.
laughs> Okay. Yes, they're all double-hauled tankers in Valdez now, and that's a federal requirement as well as a state requirement. But the tankers, the oil tankers, vessels in Cook or in Prince William Sound are double-hauled. That's correct.
So we were using tankers in two different
–
got it. That's what – thank you.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there still a lot of tanker traffic going out of some of the refineries to the North Slope hauling low sulfur fuel for fuel operation? So you know, the irony is not lost on me that we find ourselves transporting refined low sulfur fuel when they can actually produce a very fine fuel product that's very useful in the North Slope.
Yeah.
But we have found ourselves painted into a corner where we demand that we have to transport refined product from Valdez all the way back up to the North Slope when in fact with some modest sanity in the process of recognizing that maybe you can use product on the North Slope that already exists if you have a minor tweak in the sulfur requirements. Has there been any effort to kind of introduce some reasonableness in that area? I mean, it's, you know, trying to say instead of hauling all that fuel back up to the North Slope, why don't we look at tweaking the requirements so they can actually use product that's refined in the North Slope at a, you know, at a topping plant and mm-hmm. then use that? And I'd be interested in – I mean, it just seems like a reasonable thing to do to me.
Representative Birch, the chair, I'm laughing because it seems like a really unintended consequence. I think but this is out of our hands. This is Environmental Protection, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency required low sulfur fuel, and at that point, from my understanding, this predates me, that the companies running the refinery plant on the North Slope chose to no longer operate the refinery to meet the new standard, and instead buy refined fuel from Valdez and truck it up to use at their operations, which is where we are today and why we have such an increase in traffic.
Follow up. Representative Birch, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We now know somebody at EPA. is it possible that we could kind of weigh in with an opinion and say reasonable minds in Alaska would like to have a waiver, if mm-hmm. you will, and look at getting some of this truck traffic off the road and basically use as a source fuel for North Slope operations, a fuel that can actually be produced on the North Slope. But I would certainly encourage that.
Okay.
As a follow-up, Mr. Chairman, this legislation, which it's identified as a Resources Committee, but I certainly didn't have a hand in crafting it. But it says in part, the need for an enhanced civil penalty is to deter future noncompliance. And I guess my question would be, have you encountered willful noncompliance with state regulations that would necessitate increasing a daily violation from $5,000 a day to $25,000 a day? That'd be a fivefold. For some of us, that's 500%. A 500% increase in the penalty, the daily penalty. I'm just because it indicates that this increase in penalties is to deter future noncompliance. So the assumption is that there's willful noncompliance going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question is that the case?
Representative Birch, through the chair, I cannot off the top of my head think of an incident where we said this is your penalty, and they said, well, fine, we'll pay the penalty and keep doing it. But I can tell you the amounts are pretty small compared to modern economics. And when we do present them, they are definitely not something a company is concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
That it isn't necessarily something that they probably factor into their considerations when we say this is what we're going to hit you with, you better watch out. That doesn't really make them shake in their boots.
Yep. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Certainly. So you can continue.
Okay. Most of this is more generic, and I think your questions are probably more important about the bill. So, again, why we do this, these are the things we're trying to protect in our environment, things we know that we care about, that we are trying to ensure stay the way that we want them to stay. I think Representative Tara, some questions about costs at the state. There are several spills where the state has taken the lead role to clean them up because the responsible party was unable to, and at this point we're spending about $12 million in our current fiscal year to clean up some things that have occurred that the responsible party is unable to do so, and penalties could help us in those scenarios, we think. The current fine and penalty structure addresses less than 5% of our cleanup costs, so they really are incapable of helping us recoup costs in the situations where it would be useful.
If I may, and Director, and I'm trying to recall the breadth of my knowledge of this, but you said that the spill portion of your accounting has $44 million. Okay. And so $12 million would be paid, for example, in a given year, and that would come off the $44 million. Is that right?
Generally speaking, Mr. Chairman, that's correct, but not in all cases. We are able legally to use our prevention account money for paying for cleanups as well. If they're small, we might do that out of our operating budget. So some spills are picked up there, but the big ones, yes, we're using the response account.
And if the account hits a $50 million ceiling, the surcharge stops? Is that right?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. It is funded by a penny per barrel of oil. That's what fills the $50 million pot.
I mean, it strikes me that, and I'd have to think this through, that those who pay the surcharge, the one penny surcharge from 1989, I guess, that there could be some arguments that this bill would help them in that you would replenish, or you could replenish, for spills that they are not responsible for, mm-hmm. and hold yourself at $50 million, and therefore the surcharge would be frozen? Is there a possible scenario?
That's a possible scenario, yes.
Okay. Representative Rauscher.
Yes, the Chair, thank you very much. Does the state sue any offenders for costs that aren't collected through permits and cleanup costs, penalties, all that other stuff that they may have violated, and recover some of the monies? Because I see what it says there, current fine and penalty, and I didn't mean permit, I meant penalty. Current fine and penalty structure addresses less than 5% of the average oil spill response and cleanup costs. But have we been able to sue for other costs, other ways to recover those costs, I guess? And if we don't, how come? And if we do, how much?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, we are, if you look at the criteria in statute, and this bill lists those that we're allowed to consider, those are existing in statute. The bill does adjust them slightly. It does allow us to pursue recouping our costs. But the overall amounts are so low that we may hit our ceiling and not be able to achieve that complete recoupment of costs.
And that is through the chair. Hello. And that is through lawsuits.
Correct. It's all through civil penalties through courts. Through the court process. Yes.
And just on that point, to Chair Josephson, for the record, does this bill create a new set of administrative penalties so that the division doesn't have to go to the court in the first instance?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, yes. The bill, there are several programs in the department that currently have what we call administrative penalty authority, and the best analogy to me is like a ticket. It would give the department a ticketing authority. So we catch someone smoking cigarettes outside the back door, we can say, hey, don't do that. Here's the $500 ticket. So if you do a small spill, we can say, and you keep it, the way the bill is written, it's only for serious and repeat violations. So it's not just somebody smoking once, but if we catch them doing it 20 times, we say, you got to stop doing this. Here's your ticket. It would be administered by the department rather than through the court system. So it's cheaper for us to administer it, and easier. It's just one more tool in our toolbox is the way we see it. Rather than having a hammer for everything, we'd have a screwdriver and a hammer. And the amounts that are – the legislation proposes amounts that would be restricted by. But it would give us one way to get at smaller spills. It's also restricted by volume. 18,000 gallons or less, we could use this administrative penalty authority the way it's written.
And I had just one follow-up. And it was almost non-related. So fuel oil at a person's property, which goes out onto somebody else's property, if your barrel is rotting or the stand breaks, or is that addressed in this bill?
This bill increases the penalty authority for refined fuel spills. So it would be anybody who spilled refined fuel, we technically could utilize this penalty authority for, yes. Is that your question?
I think so. Do you think you've answered my question? I guess your barrel, a 500-gallon barrel, excuse the chair.
Mm-hmm.
Your 500-gallon barrel, the stand sinks and your barrel rolls off and
mm-hmm.
spills on your lawn, rolls into your neighbor's property. Is that actually addressed here?
Representative Russia, through the chair, yes. That would be under the administrative penalty section.
Okay.
So it would be 18,000 or less gallons. So, yes, that's where it would be covered.
And I would think that a person could bring a cause of action in nuisance or trespass even and seek their own damages in addition to those penalties that the state might receive.
That is correct. A responsible party, this happens frequently, is perhaps has impacted their neighbor with a spill. They always have the capacity to go in court after their neighbor for damages caused.
Representative Parrish, you had a question a few moments ago.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's a $50 million cap on the response fund, the contingency fund. And I see that $12 million on the last slide here, the estimated financial liability it cites for the division is leading investigation and cleanup efforts currently stands at $12 million. How did we come to be the leading investigator and responsible party for cleanup?
Representative Parrish, through the chair, there's a process of deciding if the state is going to become the lead responsible party or the lead cleanup. It's not something we do very often. It's only if there are statutory criteria for utilizing state funds that has to be an imminent or serious threat to the environment or public health. Once it's achieved those two criteria, then we can step in. The third criteria that's not in that same statute section but's in other sections is if there's a viable responsible party. I mean, our laws require cost recovery. They require us to recover costs whenever possible. And so if we have a viable responsible party, it's going to make more sense for them to do the work and pay for it directly than for us to do it and bill them. So usually responsible parties will take that on themselves. But in some situations, we have no responsible party. We have currently we have a junkyard in Wrangell where a person was breaking lead batteries open with a hammer for 30 years, huge lead contamination. He passed away probably from lead poisoning, I'm guessing. But this is leaching off this property across the road and into the water and contaminating shellfish harvesting areas. So the state decided this was an urgent threat. This is in a neighborhood. There's houses on all sides with wells. We decided to invest several million dollars to go in and contain that release and inoculate that dirt. There's another one in Fairbanks occurring right now, another junkyard. We have several junkyards where people have done some activities over the years that we are a little bit worried is going to harm the environment in ways that it's going to only get worse if we don't step in. So those are just two examples where we've decided the state should take the lead and invest resources to solve the problem.
Yes, Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Because of the really pernicious nature of lead poisoning, I'm glad that the state decided to jump in. It really can have terrible long-term effects on cognition and
yeah.
eventually crime. I guess I'd be interested in knowing, have we ever had to backfill the response fund or invest other state dollars in spill responses or mitigation?
Representative Parrish, through the chair, the division used to have some undesignated general funds to pay for engineering work for leak detection methodologies. This is going back, I think, to 2000 when there was a significant leak on the North Slope that was caused by a leak, and so there was a lot of information, a lot of interest in us regulating pipelines to minimize corrosion and have better leak detection technology. So there was an investment at that point of UGF in hiring engineers, pipeline engineers. But in the last couple of years, as a method to reduce state costs, we have eliminated all our UGF. We've laid off several positions. We've combined programs to try to be more efficient. So the division is now has no longer has any UGF in it, and is just relying on the prevention accounts.
Okay. Question from Representative Lincoln.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand just the scope of or how often the division has to lead in these cleanup efforts. Is it normal for that, or is it uncommon circumstances, or typically do the party that is responsible for the spill clean it up?
Representative Lincoln, through the chair, it's rare that we step in as the lead. 95% of the time, the responsible party is doing it. Now, it all depends on who that responsible party is, what that looks like. If it's an oil company, they know what they're doing, and they're just calling us saying we're doing it pretty much, and we know they're going to do it right, and we don't need to get involved. If it's a homeowner, we could be spending quite a bit of time with them, telling them what to do, helping them through this, trying to deal with it as cheaply as possible because their insurance won't help them and they're now looking at a huge cost to deal with the spill. So it varies. And then some scenarios we find out about the junkyard and there's nobody viable and there's this risk to the environment, so we step in and we do it ourselves.
Follow up.
So is the expectation that increasing the penalties and the fines will deter homeowners from taking risks or have homeowners and private citizens act more responsibly?
Representative Lincoln, through the chair, I don't foresee this being helpful with homeowners. Homeowner releases are unintended always, and I believe the actual cost of response is a huge deterrent for them in itself. I mean, as I mentioned, most insurance companies won't help you deal with it, and I have a bill in half an hour that's trying to provide some relief to homeowners in this situation. So they're not who this bill, I think, would have an impact on.
Yes, follow up, Representative Lincoln.
And then, so just to better understand the third bullet point there, so does that address the rare instances where the division has to be the lead in the cleanup?
Correct.
So, okay. And if you factor in those cases, I assume there's a lot of lawsuits that take place in that space. So if you were to factor in the recovery that happens with the typical sort of court settlement or something like that, do you have a better sense for the figure? Because it might be the penalties and the fines might be 5%, but if there are other sort of remedies in place already.
Representative Lincoln, through the chair, off the top of my head, I can't give you a sense of how much we recover. When you look at, you're right, there's a timeline that's quite long sometimes in recovery of costs. I'd have to get back to you on that.
You want to request some information?
Yeah, maybe if it's possible to include some okay. that type of information in future discussions.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You've testified as it relates to the potential that this and how it might relate to homeowners, intentional or not. Sometimes homeowners have spilled. I've got neighbors of ours in the Big Lake area in the Mat-Su that have had a Toyo stove stolen, and they've got 500 gallons or 1,000 gallons of heating fuel dumped into the ground near their home or in their home. just terrible. But is there any potential for any of these fines to be leveled against a homeowner? I mean, there's a lot of people in Alaska that use refined oil products and not natural gas to heat their home, property, and commercial enterprises. And I guess I'm kind of concerned about some of the unintended consequences here, and how that might, again, if you've got somebody that's willfully doing something, that's one matter. But if you have something that happens as an accident or a result of theft or vandalism, I'm concerned about the magnitude of the penalties that could potentially be leveled. Through the chair.
Representative Birch, through the chair, I think if you looked at the legislation and you reviewed the criteria that were to be considered when calculating a penalty, you would see it's geared definitely toward economic gains caused by the spill. So one of the main factors we're to consider is, what economic benefit occurred as a result of the spill. It's definitely looking at perhaps industry or a company that's decided to not do something that caused a release because they knew it would save them money, or they would make more money to get the fuel out quicker, and they knew there was a leak and they didn't stop the leak because they wanted to get the fuel out. You'd have to look at the criteria and the penalty that we are allowed to consider, but it's definitely geared toward economic benefit and harm to the environment. So yes, if a homeowner, if there was a lot of harm to the environment caused, they might meet that criteria, but they're definitely not going to meet some of the other criteria we're supposed to consider related to economic benefit.
And just a follow up from me on that topic, Ms. Ryan, the $100,000 you say the division may have collected in the last fiscal year, sort of a rough number.
Uh-huh.
How much of that would have been from an individual who had a spill of some sort? I assume it's a percent of it or something? I don't know.
Mr. Chairman,
if you know.
I don't off the top of my head, but I know it's small. We are, speaking of where we are right now and how we handle spills, homeowners are already reluctant to call us because we're required to recover all our costs. And that's causing more problems than it's worth, because then the sooner you catch a spill, the better your results are going to be for cleaning it up. The quicker, the better. So we do not, I and under my watch, have not penalized a homeowner that I'm aware of for that very reason. We're struggling to even avoid, we asked the governor to introduce legislation so we don't have to recover our costs from them, mm-hmm. because that's even inhibiting them calling us to give technical assistance. So I know none of that $100,000 was related to a homeowner's bill. They're struggling as it is to deal with their problem. And we want them to invest what little resources they have to clean up their problem, mm-hmm. which okay. is can run in the tens to twenties of thousands of dollars. That's such a huge hit for a homeowner without an insurance policy that will help them, that we want them to focus on that and not that's a penalty in itself.
Okay, so I think we're ready to move on to page 16.
Sorry,
no, you're fine.
Fifteen. Okay. Oil trucking. I think we've already discussed this. We are aware of two companies right now that are trucking oil, what we call a tanker truck, and they're both actually in the Kenai Peninsula. The one mentioned here is the most recent, the Cosmopolitan platform that's operated by Bluecrest Energy, and they're doing a great job. This is no reflection on any compliance issues with Bluecrest. I just toured the facility this fall and was very impressed. But they are moving oil rather than by a pipeline, by tanker truck, from Nikiski up to the refinery, and that crosses several pretty amazing water bodies and areas that I know we all care a lot about. And so this bill would require the hauling of that oil to have a contingency plan, which I'm sure the companies have given much consideration to already.
And on that point, again, Chair Josephson, I conferred with Bluecrest about that. And I guess my question is, I don't know much about contingency plans. Are they a big encumbrance, or can they be drafted in a span of a few days? How burdensome is it if you're told you need to draft a contingency plan?
Representative Josephson, the contingency plan contains two main areas. One's about prevention. What are you doing to not spill oil? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure I've actually seen documents that Blue Crest has compiled that analyze the risks of that pathway, that route that they're utilizing. What are the highest risks, and how do you mitigate those risks? So they've done all that work already. And interestingly, as far as I understand it, the biggest risk is hitting a moose. And that is the highest likely scenario to occur, very Alaskan experience. So what are they doing to minimize hitting moose? I don't know. I don't know what they're doing actually about that. But that's what goes into the prevention aspects of a contingency plan. The other aspect of a contingency plan is, what will you do if you spill oil? How are you going to pick it up? Where do you have equipment pre-deployed? If it goes into a river, it's a fast-moving river. Where is it right to have your boom right there at the truck, or should you have it a mile down where you're more likely to get it deployed in time to catch it? It's thinking through what might happen and being prepared for the most likely scenarios. That's the point of a contingency plan. I don't see them as a significant amount of work from that perspective. I think it's things the companies do anyway as part of good business practice. Mm-hmm. But it does require them to put it in a specific format and provide it to the department. And the one aspect they may or may not be doing is drilling and exercising those plans to see if they can do what they say they're going to do, which is what we would require.
Okay. Thank you. Question?
Yes.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you. Now that we're talking about the tankers, that is what you were talking about before. And so just thinking about this, I mean, they're limited in that's the only basically travel route that they can use.
Right.
But are there otherwise any other restrictions in terms of time of travel or I guess that's really the only thing I can think of, maybe if it was like, you know, limited, so less interference with business traffic or something like that?
Representative Tarr, I don't that would fall probably more to DOT at this point. I don't believe, and I know they've been a very proactive operator. I know they've had conversations with DOT about what they should and shouldn't be doing, and I think they're stopping at way stations to make sure they're in compliance with those rules. So that probably would fall more to DOT to restrict travel times, and I don't know if we could go into that in a contingency plan. That might be outside our bounds.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. There's one other aspect of this legislation I wanted to mention. It is the inclusion of produced water when we calculate the volume of a penalty. There are two examples on the slide explaining what that would do in those two instances. On the North Slope, as those fields have matured, produced water has become more frequent as the oil has become less frequent. And for everybody, I don't know if you understand this or not, but produced oil is essentially salt water that's infiltrated the reservoir, and so when they're pulling up what oil is left, they're getting more and more water. The problem in our existing statutes is that is not considered as a factor, as not something we're allowed to consider as a factor in the penalty volume. Yet we find it to be is toxic to the environment, is the oil, and sometimes harder to deal with. It's hard to wash salt away. Oil, we actually have some tools that we can use to break it down quicker, whereas salt tends to stick around, and the tundra environment is very sensitive to it. So from our perspective, we feel that the damage caused to the environment by produced waters is significant, and it should be considered in the volume calculations for penalties. So
I have two questions about this.
Yes.
The first is, to your knowledge, looking at the other 49 states, I guess, if we adopt this language that says produced water matters also in the calculation, are we doing things differently than our sister states?
Reference Josephson to the chair. I'm going to check and get back to you on that. I want to make sure I have the right answer.
Okay. My second question is, on the left side, you talk about not eclipsing this 18,000-gallon limit. Is that to highlight that under the bill you could have penalized them administratively?
Correct.
Okay. So that's what you're trying to...
It's just an instance that it wouldn't, it would have stayed below. It would have been in that threshold where the penalties are less.
Okay. Any
questions? Still something. I mean, we often have spills where it's maybe a couple gallons of oil, but hundreds and thousands of gallons of produced water. It's the formula has shifted on what's being spilled.
Okay. Representative Parrish.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the relative impact for a gallon of produced water as opposed to, say, a gallon of oil? Is there any guideline? Or I know that if you've got a gallon of slurry, its density may vary tremendously. Is there any acknowledgement of that, or is there a best way of getting at that?
Representative Parrish, through the chair, it varies by every spill. It could be very could be a lot of salt in the water, or there could be hardly any. I mean, every scenario is really different. I can't really tell you if there's a standard. I can just tell you that the more salt that's in the water, the harder it's. We really don't have good cleanup tools to address a produced water spill that's highly saline, and it has pretty big impact on the environment.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions from the panel of Ms. Ryan?
I have many follow-up things to get back to you on.
Okay, great. So at this time, what we will do is I'll have Mr. Atkinson present the bill, and we have the PowerPoint. It's much less redundant than I thought it was. So we'll march through the bill section by section, and the PowerPoint will let you see some of the history, and it varies depending on the section of when the dollar amount for the penalty was last changed, if it was ever changed. So, Mr. Atkinson, if you're ready to put your name on the record,
you may proceed. Mr. Chairman, Tom Atkinson, staff to Representative Josephson, just figuring out how to display this.
So you've got it in the PDF.
Thank you. It can be difficult to understand this bill without looking at the individual sections, so that's the intent here this afternoon. Section 1 is findings, and these are not new, and they're not enforceable. I can't tell you exactly when these findings were inserted, but I can point out to you the proposed changes to them, and you'll see on page 1 of the bill, line 7, we would take out recent information discloses that, because we don't even know when that was a reference to recent. There's a little bit of grammar cleanup in the top of page 2, changing that to which and ensure spelling differently. Line 15, but not punitive, proposing to take that out because some of the penalties, both civil and administrative, could be considered punitive. And then because in the next line, 16, we take out civil because the bill proposes to add administrative penalties. So we don't want the findings to be restricted just to civil. And then similarly, line 7 in that first section is we take out judicial because the findings would apply to both civil fines assessed by a court, which would be judicial, or administrative fines assessed by the department.
Any questions there? Okay, continue.
Section 2 increases regulatory penalties for non-crude oil spills over 18,000 gallons. You'll see that 18,000 gallon threshold frequently. That's a threshold that exists in current statutes, and this statute mostly deals with aquatic environments, but you'll see that there are, so if we're looking at, in Section 2 regards AS 4603758B, and then paragraphs A, B, and C. C is for releases unconfined saltwater environment or public land. A and B are strictly aquatic. And it's a stair step down, A, B, and C, that you'll note that the penalties in existing law are more severe for a release into an anadromous stream or other freshwater environment with significant aquatic resources. And then, so logically, as the receiving environment is less biologically important, fines are decrease. And I put in this slide for your understanding that these penalties were last changed, or actually first imposed in 1977. So as you know from your own money management, the money's worth less. That inflation has undercut the value of that dollar. So within 1977, the $1 per gallon penalty for release into anadromous waters, if we looked at the 2018 equivalent of $10, it'd be $39.70. But the bill proposes about half that much, $20.
And I'd ask the committee to sort of take note of that. We did, in crafting this, consult with the department, but the actual inflation adjustment that we've run would suggest that, at least in this section, the penalties would be quite a bit higher if they tracked the 1977 rate and were adjusted. Any questions about that? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so even though they're not basically fully inflation adjusted, the increased amount was adequate from the point of the view from the department that it would, you know, achieve what was necessary.
Mr. Atkinson?
Co-Chair Tarr, through the chair, yes. That was the amount suggested by the department.
Thank you.
In this section. All right, if we're ready to move on to the next section, Section 3 directs the Department of Environmental Conservation to increase civil penalties annually for non-crew discharges into aquatic environments. So the intent of this section is to inflation adjust automatically. And that's one of the reasons we're in the situation we are now, is that there was no automatic inflation adjustment when these penalties were originally enacted. So that the value of the penalty, if you will, has eroded since then. So this section is an attempt to prevent such erosion over time. It'd be adjusted annually per the Consumer Price Index. And the visual on this page just shows you where we calculated the inflation from the U.S. Department of Labor.
Okay. No questions. We'll continue on to slide. Oh, sorry. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just not. Are there any other instances? I'm sure we have penalties everywhere in statute. You know, kind of across the board. And I'm just curious: are we aware? Is the author aware of any other instances where we have some sort of a annualized bump up the penalty? Whether it's speed and tick, any sort of finer penalties. Is that a practice that happens elsewhere, or is this something unique, or do we have a standard for escalating penalties, if you will, on an annual basis? I don't know.
Well, I would say that one of them, and I'm trying to remember whether we repealed this in November or not, but one was Senate Bill 91 and the value of property relative to C felonies and the cap, and when a C felony is threatened based on, so it was a $500 TV could result in a C felony, theft of a TV, and now it's $1,250 or $750 or whatever. So there's that instance for sure.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Birch, I think it's fairly common throughout the statutes. I can't report to you any examples now, but I'll find some for you. I think it depends on whether the legislature had the foresight at the time to insert an inflation adjustment. Yes.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I was just going to say this is something that's come up in conversations like with Division of Occupational Licensing, and I think there is a move you know, for in some areas where that hasn't been the historically the case, to move to that because of it sort of burdens the legislature with having to take up individual pieces of legislation every single time, you know, to address one of those. Or another way I've seen it is increased receipt authority. So say for like the Marine Highway or something, you know, if they get increased receipt authority, that allows them to make adjustments in the ticket price. So those are just kind of a couple of examples. But I know from the administration, because I was looking at stuff in occupational licensing, that they were looking at some reforms over there in for the same reason of just trying to figure out how to reduce the administrative part of it because, you know, our time is limited.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
So I have a couple of questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, a couple of things. CPI doesn't always increase because I have some contracts that are tied to the CPI, and I know that the CPI in Anchorage has not went up. Well, it may have this year, but it didn't last a couple of years, or it hasn't in the past. So we basically doubled all the fees, and then we're using that as a base, and then we're going to – that's going to be the base, and now we're going to tie it to the CPI. So next year we'll use the base – that's in here, which is the new doubled amount, and then we'll go potentially up from there. Is that correct?
That's correct as to that section, yes.
Okay. I mean, it looks similar throughout, but okay. So, and is that fairly arbitrary, the doubling? I mean, like, is there any reason to go for a doubled amount or?
I think I would have to. I don't know the answer. I think the department might want to respond to that, or could, if they're interested. Nothing's mandatory.
We don't have to go into complete detail. Okay. I mean, it seems kind of arbitrary, that's all. I'm just trying to figure out where we're,
you know, Mr. Chairman.
What exactly we're doing, because we could go, I mean, we could have potentially taken the base rate and then done a CPI indexing on it and came up with a number and, you know, I'm just wondering what thought it was that got us to this point. That's all.
And we could discuss if the bill moves to amendments and at some point and there's a hearing of that sort, then we could have that discussion for sure.
Okay.
Representative Parrish.
Oh, I just thought it might be useful to return to. I believe we just were there. Return to section two. The slide shows you where. Yes, we are doubling, but it fails to remotely keep track with inflation. In fact, it looks like we're doing slightly less than splitting the difference. The amount proposed in this legislation is almost uniformly half of what the inflation-adjusted amount would be, and that seems like it's quite a compromise already baked in. That's all. I just thought this slide might be useful for context. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rauscher, did you have a question?
I'll hold my question. Okay.
Representative
later.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, it kind of goes to, you know, who actually drafted this, and that's one of my objections to having it just kind of under the Resources Committee. But on page two, line. Let's see, no, excuse me, page 4, line 8, as I indicated earlier, the daily fine rate can be a maximum of $25,000 rather than $5,000. So somebody suggested $25,000, which is five times $5,000. And I guess where did that come from? Who said, gee, that ought to be $25,000? Is that I don't know who wrote this. So I through the chair.
I can tell you that my office was very involved in writing this. Okay. It's a committee bill, as you know. I know you're not pleased with that, but it is. We will get to that section. We'll inquire. But it's a perfectly good question.
You don't know. You can't. I'm just curious as to who's.
Let me ask Mr. Atkins. Mr. Atkins,
five times a fivefold increase was adequate or less than adequate, but it's certainly much more than double. So I'm
aware that it's more than double.
Brains behind this.
So let me take his question first and ask Mr. Atkinson. Do you know where the $25,000 number comes from.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure what section he's referring to because we hadn't got.
He's referring to Section 6 of the bill itself.
Okay, so we're only in Section 4, so that's why. Okay.
Well, we're talking, if I might, we're talking doubling of fines, and I mean, at first blush, you look to something, and it's a five times, which is certainly much more than doubles, and hence the relevance. And I'm trying to figure out whose idea this all was. I assume it came out of your office, so I'm just trying to understand, you know, what the justification was for a fivefold increase.
Right, we've got that. You've said it.
Representative Roach, through the chair, in general, the proposed fine amount, penalty amounts came from the department. Some of them were adjusted in our office just to, because when we did the inflation calculations, they came out to be almost double, in some cases, depending on when the original penalties were enacted, and so we just made it neater. But in the case, more specifically, of the quintupling of some, those were for continued violations. Those came from the department. We did not change them in Josephson's office, in the co-chair's office. And I believe the intent there was to get the attention of someone, a responsible party, that let a spill continue because it wasn't costing them enough to make it worthwhile to stop. The penalty wasn't costing them enough. So the only place, Representative Birch, through the chair, that you'll see a quintupling is for continuing violations, not initial violations.
Okay. And that came from the department? Then, I believe.
Representative Birch, through the chair, yes, it did.
Okay, thank you.
So, Representative Rauscher, was it Representative Johnson?
I think so, but since we're on, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Since we're on Section 6, I'm assuming that the quintupling of this violation is perhaps explained in item 4, line 19, the need for an enhanced civil penalty to deter future noncompliance. I guess, I mean, having sat through the SB 91 discussion, I thought the general consensus was increasing penalties for doing bad things really didn't deter much. So that just goes to philosophy, not necessarily that Rep. Josephson's office had necessarily supported that view. But anyway, I just wanted to point that out. It was seemed interesting to me.
All right. So we're on to take us where we were. We're on Section 4 of the PowerPoint on this bill. Are there any other questions about that PowerPoint slide?
We haven't done it yet.
Oh, I guess we haven't done it yet.
Shall I proceed?
Yes, please.
Thank you. So Section 4 was initially, the penalties were enacted in 1989 in the wake of the Exxon Valdez spill, and they have not been changed since then. This is an example, Representative Birch, of where the $8 penalty for a spill under 420,000 gallons, the 2018 equivalent run through the Consumer Price Index online calculator is 1564, and we rounded it up for a neat doubling. And then you'll see that there was a similar effect for spills in excess of 420,000 gallons.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In reference to the and all of this so far, actually, we've talked about the cost of responding to a spill cleanup, but I don't recall yet any reference to the costs of environmental damages for instance, the fishermen whose livelihoods were adversely impacted and for whom the state had some degree of responsibility. Do you have any estimate on those costs with, say, a spill of 400,000 gallons? I guess it would be highly dependent on where, which is reflected in the earlier differential in the costs for anadromous streams, estuaries, and the open ocean. But is there any data available on that? I I should be interested in knowing.
Representative Parrish, through the chair, I didn't bring any data on that.
Thank you.
Representative Rauscher.
Through the chair, just on reference to the last question, I think that where it says liable to the state in a civil action or civil penalty, in other words, they have already done damage to the environment, and now let's take it into account in that statement. I may be wrong. Is that what that's saying?
Can you repeat the question?
He's wanting to know what, why any I believe his question was, and I don't want to speak for him, but I believe his question was that he wanted to take into account environmental damage that may be caused to the state. And the answer was not really found, and I'm thinking, is it answered in liable to the state for civil action? Because that would have gone after him for civil action, so is it addressed in that sentence? We're in four.
Right.
A.
Yes.
I'm not sure what the question is. A civil action is a lawsuit brought by the state. So if someone spills something, they're liable to the state. This increases the fines.
I believe that answered his question.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying.
Okay. All right.
I just thought his answer... question didn't get answered, and I thought that's where the answer was.
I'm not sure.
I may be wrong.
Representative Parrish, you want to clarify?
Thank you, Mr. Okay. Chair. I'll try. So in dramatic cases such as the Exxon oil spill, there's a certain damage which is done to the state directly. There's a certain cost to the state and clean up and containment directly to the state. And then there's a considerable cost to members of the public, which can be responded to and through civil actions, although that can take, as we've seen, decades. My question would be about the indirect cost to the state, things like the need to provide alternate job training for the people in impacted industries. And the indirect cost to the state, it's not entirely clear to me if the state can seek redress for that, or if it would be a matter for the people directly impacted.
I apologize to the representative for not understanding that part of his question.
So, I mean, I think I can help, and I'm not a tort lawyer, but under Title IX and the case law that interprets Title IX, a person can seek full compensatory damages. They have to prove liability, and they have to prove the damages after proving liability. And you can make all sorts of arguments. And when they get more attenuated, they get worse. But beyond that, I don't know that the bill really deals directly with that question.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Anything else on slide 4? Okay. We'll move to slide 5.
Section 5, Mr. Chairman, calculates the penalty amounts by counting produced water mixed with crude oil as crude oil, when this is something Director Ryan has already addressed. And then, again, in this section, it directs DEC to increase civil penalties annually per the CPI if the CPI shows an increase.
Okay. Seeing no questions, we'll move to Section 6.
Section 6 was first enacted. The penalties were first enacted in 1976 and have not been changed since then. So this is for illegal discharges of oil and crude oil under the threshold of 18,000 gallons. And this includes several other substances, which are listed in the sub-bullet there. Ballast water, pesticides, paints, and discharges from underground storage tanks, cruise ships, and illegal drug sites. So this doubles the maximum penalty for the initial violation, quintuples the maximum penalty for continuing violation for the reasons that we've already discussed, and allows a court to increase maximum penalty to deter future spills. And you can take a look at the chart there down below the table, rather. The 2018 equivalent of a 1976 penalty would be $2,000, $2,118, but the amount is in the bill is proposed to be half of that, $1,000. And similarly, on down the line, except for the everyday after violation, which is actually larger than inflation for the aforementioned reasons to get the responsible party to stop the spill.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just trying to wrap my head around this. Mostly, when I think about an oil spill, I think about the horrible misfortune that happened in 1989. But most of the time when we talk about spills in Alaska, that's not the kind of spill we're talking about. And I guess my concern is if I think about, for instance, and I'm hoping that if this is correct. So you have, for instance, of some young entrepreneur that has one boat, whether it's a tourist boat or a fishing boat, or to have one thing, and they have a spill. And spills are not an on and off switch. We all know that. Anytime, I mean, it can take a long time to get someone that's actually qualified to come out and do the response. It can spread. It's, you know, so the violation. I think I understand the intent of the $25,000 a day, but so now we went from something small, which would be maybe a $500, maybe, you know, a few $1,000 offense, until just within a few days, you're talking about an amount of money that there's no way that can really be got out from. I mean, this is bankruptcy kinds of activity within a few days for some small small company. So I guess I just was wondering if you could give me a kind of a for instance on that. Is that my looking at that correctly, or is this only for larger companies?
Mr. Atkinson.
Representative Johnson, through the chair. No, this would apply to all spills, but note that it allows a court to increase maximum penalty to deter future spills. So a court doesn't have to increase the maximum penalty to deter future spills and could take into account the size of the operator and the attempts of the responsible party to stop the spill. The flip side of your question, Representative Johnson, I believe, is there are some sizable companies that, especially when the price of oil was high, might decide that it's they're making more money and just letting the spill continue, and because the fines have been eroded. So the each day after violation quintupling is an intent to get them to change their thinking on that, a large operator.
Follow up?
So did I understand you to say that these penalties that we're describing here do not have to be applied? I mean, the court can choose, or did you say they don't, the maximum doesn't have to be applied?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, the maximum does not have to be applied. The minimum does.
And so when we talk about a minimum of $25,000, we're talking about a minimum of $25,000 a day?
No.
I mean, that's the minimum?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, no, the minimum is currently $500, and we're proposing to raise it to $1,000. And that's for the entire spill.
So the $25,000 is the maximum, not more than $25,000 a day.
Representative Johnson, through the chair, yes.
Yes. Okay. Representative Rauscher.
Real quick, thank you, through the chair. Is this representative of a gas leak, say, at the bottom of Cook Inlet? That went on for months.
Well, my understanding, and we could ask Director Ryan to answer it again, but my understanding is that the department concluded that was not within its jurisdiction. Am I wrong? And the discussion we had last year was whether AOGCC could issue fines. But perhaps we need one more time a little clarification on that. If you'll approach.
Yes. For the record, my name is Kristen Ryan. I am the director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. The department concluded that that was a release of a hazardous substance into the environment. So, yes, as the bill is written, the department would make the case that the penalties would apply to that release of that substance. But I assume it would be challenged.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your answer.
And actually, I'll ask a question following up on that. Ms. Ryan, was the release at issue in the Cook Inlet, which was about a year ago, did the department seek the minimum $500 fines?
Mr. Chairman, we did not seek any penalties in that scenario. No, we did not.
But the department could have done that. You think because natural gas is a hazardous substance and it was leaked into a water body, I guess, that you had the authority to do it?
Correct.
And, I mean, my memory is that there's an argument that Hillcorp acted, some might say, there could be an argument about how responsibly they acted, but certainly there's an argument that they did act responsibly or tried to. And that some of these were acts of God and those sorts of things.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I would point out, I know there's been lots of debate about the amounts of the potential penalties, but the legislation and existing statute point to the criteria we are to consider when calculating those penalties. And your ability to, your intent to stop the spill is a criteria we are to consider, or the courts are to consider. So if you are a responsible operator and you get on it right away and you minimize the damage, that's going to greatly impact the amount of penalty, if any, that's calculated. And in this situation, Hillcorp was a responsible operator. They yes, a leak occurred, and they did what they could to stop it. And so I don't think we found grounds to initiate penalties.
And as I recall, just for the record, my memory is that because of ice conditions, they had difficulty checking and accessing and testing and doing those sorts of things. Now, that begs the question of the safety of the operation of any gas line in the wintertime, but that's a separate question.
Follow up?
Yes, Representative Rauscher.
Okay. So I guess I'm just trying to figure out what this whole paragraph is all about. Any person who violates or causes or permits to be violated a provision, a person. Could this be somebody who's watching over the project and hired by the state?
Representative Rush,
not seeing it today?
Representative Rush, through the chair, I would have to defer to the Department of Law of how they define person. I think that's a broader issue than this bill. But I know from our perspective, we consider the responsible party to be the owner of the product released.
Through the chair.
Yes. Follow. Representative.
But I'm reading this paragraph, and it says it's the person causes a provision to be violated.
What's your question, Representative Rauscher?
Can the state be charged?
I don't know. What do you think,
Representative Rauscher, through the chair? Yes, sometimes the state is the responsible party. I can give an example of the Department of Transportation. You know, sometimes spills fuel. We work with them to clean it up, like we do all responsible parties. But I think if you read the letter of the law, yes, I think it would give the authority to DEC to penalize a sister agency if they were a responsible party. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Representative Parrish, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Section 6, subsection 1 and subsection 2, there's the word reasonable. In practice, that's, I believe, meant to prevent the sort of situation that Representative Johnson was alluding to, where there could be an unreasonable fine assessed. But reasonable, unreasonable, that's largely subjective and subject to custom. Would you say, on average, that the fines assessed err on the side of aggressive or err on the side of caution when it comes to a perfect, reasonable ruling?
Representative Parrish, to the chair, I think historically the department has been very reasonable in its assessment of penalties, and I did receive the number of penalties received last year, and it was $82,000. That gives you an indication, I think, that we're pretty – it's not a tool we use that – we haven't used frequently, or at least the amounts are also pretty low. And I know there was much debate about where the numbers came from Representative Birch. That was a decision – a recommendation by the department based on what other states charge and what the Environmental Protection Agency rates are. We're below that. They're, I believe, at $39,000 for every day that release is not contained. So we were looking for models elsewhere when we recommended those numbers.
And let me follow up on that briefly. When you said you looked at other jurisdictions, as other authorities, did you find that for the initial violation, as Mr. Atkinson explained, the sort of the policy position, that other jurisdictions were, when there was a failure after an initial violation to clean up, that the imposition of a fine grew exponentially that way?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And that is the whole intent of encouraging somebody to stop a release. You want them to stop the release, so the fine is in exponentially bigger because of that. But again, I point to the criteria. It is not a guarantee. It depends on what actions the company is taking. If they are unable to stop the release for some reason, that is to be considered in the penalty amount. It's not a blanket decision.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also noteworthy that the 2018 equivalent based on the consumer price index would not be that much less than the proposed fine, at least on that number. Representative Lincoln. Sure, please.
So I've got a couple of questions, some of this definition. So back to your presentation, the definition of a large spill, one of the slides said that large spills account for over 80%. Is that the $18,000 gallon figure?
Yes, Mr. Lincoln, that's okay. There, Representative Lincoln.
And it also talks in the same slide, processed water, and then in the bill, produced water. Are they different? What is processed water and what is produced water?
Representative Lincoln, through the chair, processed water is associated with mining activity, and so it's the water they use to create the slurry to get the elements out of the rock they're attempting to get it. It's not uncommon for a spill of that slurry to occur. They usually pick it back up and deal with it. That's different from produced water, which is water that comes up from oil exploration in the wellhead that they then have to contend with.
Okay. And then,
yes, follow up.
Next question is, you know, we're being introduced to some incremental changes in a lot of different places. So, you know, the cost per gallon of different penalties, and then also including produced water in the spill. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for me to evaluate just because these things compound, right? And I'm just wondering if there's a way to model these things in a combined way. I don't know if it's possible to, like, what your data is like over the last, you know, a few decades of, you know, dealing with spills, if it's possible to kind of apply these changes in a concerted kind of cumulative way so that we can have a better understanding of the magnitude of the changes when, you know, taken together. I don't know if that's a reasonable request or not, because I don't know what the state of your information is in right now, or if you could just build an Excel formula and spit it out, you know, but
okay.
It would be helpful in some way to kind of put all these variables together so that we can, you know, get a better appreciation for exactly the magnitude of the change that we're contemplating.
Representative Lincoln, through the chair, I appreciate that. I do have good data about what's been spilled and how it was spilled and where it was spilled. We haven't necessarily kept good records of penalties we've charged over the years. That gets a little harder for me to track, but I'll do the best that I can to give you that information. I would just give a brief overview that this statute, as you can tell, is written sort of
complicated. One section is penalties for oil, one section is penalties for non-oil, and then there's another section that covers both of them for under 18,000 gallons. And so it there's some overlap and back and forth, and that's why you're seeing so many multiple similar changes.
Another?
I just say, if I might, Mr. Chair, I'm really new to this role, and I really appreciate the discourse today. That's, you know,
good.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's you had mentioned earlier, again through the chair, that you know, the state of Alaska may have, we kind of talk about this, and oftentimes it's we and them, but we actually entrust Alyeska Pipeline and the transportation system to transport our royalty share of that oil, which may be as much as one-eighth of the oil that's. How does that work if you have a crude oil spill and you know, one-eighth of it is actually, you know, ours? How does that end up getting, to the extent that the owner of the oil is actually the one that's responsible, how does that actually get represented back to the owner of the oil and our share of the oil in the fining process or the penalty process? Through the chair.
Representative, to the chair, the ownership in our minds is not complicated by the royalty that goes to the state of Alaska. That is actually something that's up in the revenue cloud and not in my cloud. So we are regulating Alyeska, we're regulating ConocoPhillips, we're regulating BP. In our minds, they are the responsible party that's managing the exploration or production or processing of the product that we're monitoring. So they own and hold the contingency plans, and that's who we legally hold accountable for managing that properly. How they provide their share to the state is, I don't.
So
follow up.
So irrespective of whether, you know, BP has a share and ConocoPhillips has a share and the state of Alaska has a share, that's kind of that ownership, if you will, and there is ownership there, that doesn't really enter into the engagement where you're looking primarily at the system operator, if you will, in the course of leveling penalties and so forth.
Representative Birch, through the chair, Alyeska is a great example. I mean, all that oil is commingled in that pipeline, and it's Alyeska who's the responsible party in case there's a release of that oil once they're in possession of it.
Okay. So. Thank you.
Okay. So, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, so I this is a follow-up to Representative Lincoln's question, and I think it's just clear sort of some of the categories now. I was looking back. So, like, Section 2 is non-crude discharges over 18,000 gallons.
Correct.
Section 4 is crude over 18,000. Section 6 is crude under 18,000.
And so non-crude. That's
right. And so it's really, yes, if you're trying to look at cumulative, you know, you should probably just fit in. You're either, you know, non-crude over 18,000 or you're crude under 18,000 or crude over.
Correct.
But you're not going to be penalized in each of those categories.
Correct. That is right.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Atkinson, you're at the plate. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just before we leave Section 6, I know you want to go stepwise here, but proposed added language in paragraph 4, the need for an enhanced civil penalty to deter future noncompliance, mirrors page 6 of the bill, lines 22 through 23, at the very tail end of Section 9. So for that kind of a spill that's addressed in Section 9, there's already an enhanced civil penalty to deter future noncompliance. And in Section 6, we're proposing to give a court that same authority.
So the point you're making is the concept isn't a new one in this code?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
So Section 7 allows... is just conforming amendment, which you'll see later on in the bill.
Okay.
Section 8, again, is a substantive section. Those penalties were first enacted in 1984 and have not been changed. Doubles the minimum penalty for discharges of hazardous waste. It doubles maximum penalty for the initial violation. and it multiplies the maximum penalty for a continuing violation by 2.5. So it's not a quintupling here. It's 2.5.
Okay. All right. Questions about that? Not seeing any. So we'll move to Section 9.
Section 9, Mr. Chairman, civil penalties enacted by voter initiative in 2006 have not been raised since then. It doubles the maximum penalty for discharges from cruise ships under discharges under 18,000 gallons, same threshold, but from cruise ships. It doubles the maximum penalty for the initial violation and multiplies the maximum penalty for continuing violation by 2.5.
Okay. And the committee should know that the PowerPoint that you may have should reflect that in the second column it's 2006 penalties in orange there, not 1984 penalties. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hmm. So there's a typo there.
Mm-hmm. And thanks to Brandon at AOGA for pointing that out.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this isn't actually something being altered in the bill, so I'm happy to return to it on some other occasion. But it's interesting that that an employee could be the liable party, it seems, based on Section 9, first line of F, rather than the owner of a commercial passenger vessel. That's just a point of interest. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And it's not uncommon. It's an interesting point. It's not uncommon as legislators for us to see something that's been there all along, and we take note of it. Questions? Representative Rauscher.
Yes, through the chair, this is just a curiosity because I haven't seen it. How much of this is actually existing that we're just rewriting? In other words, have we just rewritten some language that was already there in all of this with just adding penalties to a higher amount, or have we added new language to change the existing language in code?
So I'd refer you to Section 3 and 5 as adding new subsections on the Consumer Price Index, because that wasn't there at all. But essentially, these are amendments to existing law. Section 11 is we're coming to, and that's a new subsection, as is Section 12. So it's those parts.
So there's some. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, Mr. Atkinson.
Section 10, Mr. Chairman, describes the factors a court may consider when determining economic benefit of noncompliance. So that's the situation that we've discussed earlier this afternoon, where a responsible party, probably a big operator, determines that it costs less to keep spilling because the fines are low, and it's making a lot of money when the price of oil is high. So in that case, that would be an economic benefit of noncompliance, and this lays out the factors that a court can consider as part of that economic benefit: deferred and avoided cost of compliance with the standard violated, competitive advantage gained by the noncompliance with the standard violated, income derived as a result of noncompliance with the standard violated from operations that were not authorized or permitted.
And the one question I would have is the term economic savings is what we call in the law a term of art, and I don't know if this is the first use of it in Alaska law. I'm sensing it's not. So we're not crafting this from whole cloth. This is something that courts and the statutes use. Is that? I'm getting the affirmative from Director Ryan on my comments. Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that been a problem? I mean, do we have a history of having people ignoring their spills because they don't have time to go, or there's no economic benefit to go cleaning them up under our fine schedule or fee schedule?
Well, yes. I mean, I think I could take notice of that fact just by reading the newspaper, that we know that people, I mean, the troopers get involved because it can become criminal.
So unfortunately, that's a characteristic of human behavior that happens. But we hope it doesn't.
So, yes. Yeah. So I guess since this is a committee bill, I guess it requires a little more thorough look, as far as I'm concerned, as far as what the vision for the bill is, and that's what I've been trying to do. Because if this we're going forward, this isn't one individual's bill. This is our bill, and we need to know what the vision is that we're moving this forward under. So at first, I was like, okay, are we just changing all the fees? We're going to double them, but that's not entirely what we're doing. We're changing the fees, and then we're adding some higher caps on the penalties. And I'm, again, kind of like I have to agree with Representative Birch is that who wrote it and why? I mean, I look at a lot of bills that way. Who wrote it and why are we doing this? And so I'm still trying to figure out what the problem is we're trying to fix. And if we're trying to fix a shortfall in our revenue, do we need to do an aggressive fee and fine schedule? We're not going to get it with an extra, you know, $500 here and there. Or if it's not to do that, then what are we going after, really?
Well, Representative Johnson, I'll respond briefly. A lot of this was already answered, but 1977, January, Jimmy Carter was sworn into office. About half the world wasn't alive then, so it's a very long time ago.
May I just say that at that point, that day, I was marching in President Carter's inaugural parade with my clarinet. But anyway, just a side note, it was maybe a little long time.
There could be a blogger that takes note of that. and we'll have a conversation about that.
It was a while ago, and I was alive. But I'm just getting to the vision on the bill.
Sure. So the vision is that it came to our attention that these fines have become so outdated as to be, I don't want to say laughable, but something just short of that. And these statutes are crying out for updating. So that's the vision. It's, you know, the essence of it is if these numbers were correct at their inception, then they should be changed now, or otherwise they weren't correct at their inception. They were too high. So if they were right in 1977 and 1986 and 2006, they're right now under the bill. That's the vision I have. Okay. All right, we're going to wrap this up. And so where are we? We're on Section 11.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, we're still on Section 11. I did want to bring the committee's attention to Line 12 on page 7, other penalties assessed for the same violation, and you'll see how that has a nexus to Section 12, which starts on the same page. And the idea there is that the court must take into consideration any administrative penalties levied by the department, but must offset the court's civil penalty. In other words, subtract the administrative penalty from the civil penalty.
Right. And the committee should take note that in subsection H on page 7, you can see there's opportunities to argue mitigators and say, I, the unfortunate negligent actor, did these things that should minimize the penalty. Okay. Seeing no questions, we'll move on to Section 12.
Section 12, Mr. Chairman, is where the administrative penalties begin. All the foregoing, the previous 11 sections, all have to do with civil penalties. Well, Section 1 has to do with fines, but so Section 12 is all new.
Okay.
And it authorizes DEC to assess new administrative penalties in addition to the civil penalties for serious or repeated illegal discharges. And I think that might go to Representative Johnson's earlier question about a small operator, a fisherman, or someone who just spilled a little. This wouldn't apply because it's for serious or repeated illegal discharges, and those are terms of art already well understood by the department. They use serious and repeated. They're defined elsewhere. For the initial violation, DEC could penalize the responsible party no less than $1,000, no more than $10,000, and no more than $24 per gallon spilled. Now, we're not changing any of those. Those there were suggestions from the department, because there's lots of been lots of questions from the committee about the genesis of these penalty amounts. So those were the suggestions from the department.
Okay.
It also describes the factors DEC must consider when assessing administrative penalties, so they're not just making it up. There's some guidelines for them. Allows DEC to sue the responsible party who doesn't pay the administrative penalty. If they do sue the responsible party that doesn't pay the administrative penalty, the court could not adjust the administrative penalty. Normally courts can, but the court must award prevailing parties attorney's fees and collection costs. That's normal operating procedure, and the court must subtract the administrative penalty from any eventual civil penalty. And then it goes on to incorporate some aspects that you saw in previous sections, like including the water mixed with oil when determining the spill volume. It directs DEC to inflation-proof administrative penalties, as we've seen in previous sections, and it defines oil for this section only to include crude, petroleum, and any substance refined from oil.
Okay. Continue.
All right, sections 13 through 18 are all regarding the trucking of crude, and it would require a commercial motor vehicle used to transport crude oil to have an approved contingency plan.
Okay. And Director Ryan covered that at some length.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Section 19 repeals, this is housekeeping, came from Ledge Legal, repeals legislative disapproval of regulations governing civil penalties for oil discharges, because that's a separation of powers issue that it's been taken up before, and that's the purview of the administration, not of the legislature. It repeals prohibition against punitive penalties for illegal discharges of ballast water, pesticides, paints, underground storage tanks, cruise ships, illegal drug sites, because it could be argued that some of the heavy fines for continuing violations are punitive.
Okay. We're just about done. All right. And then finally, we have some effective dates.
Yes.
And we have two of them.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, the effective dates are crafted to give the authority to DEC to start adopting regulations now, because that takes months. And if enacted, if this bill is enacted, the regulations would take effect January 1st. The entire bill would take effect January 1st, 2019, by which time DEC should have finished adopting their regulations. That would also give truckers time to get their C plans approved.
Okay. With that, we're going to do a little bit of housekeeping. The first thing is that if there are any questions about the bill that occur to you between now and Monday or whenever, you can pose them to me or Director Ryan or to Tom Atkinson. We are going to hear this bill on Monday. We're going to have invited and public testimony. On Wednesday, we're going to have a presentation. This might interest Director Ryan as well. From Crowley, the title is "Transition from Crowley to Edison." Shuey.
West.
Tom set me up because he said it must be Shuey, and it sure reads Shuey. Offshore for Prince William Sound and Valdez Marine Terminal Prevention Response, and. So Alieska will be making that presentation, and I encourage you to do whatever research you want to do to get ready for that. Then on the same day, Wednesday, we'll be hearing more on House Bill 217, which we probably heard last year.
Nope, just the other day.
Okay, just the other day. And then we'll also be meeting, forewarning you, on Wednesday night to look at HB 322, the bill you've just heard about, and to take up amendments. We'll give you probably a deadline that you'll hear about on Monday for amendments on Tuesday evening. So you have that advance notice, and we might extend that to Wednesday morning. And then Friday we're going to take up HB 305, which I think is the governor's bill.
Mm-hmm.
If there aren't any questions, we will adjourn this Friday, the 2nd of February meeting at 3:03.